Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters engage today's top thinkers from around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas you can put to use in your personal and professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, Close Up Radio digs deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. Close Up Radio, where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn. It's nice to be back with you again here on Close Up Talk Radio. Yes, we dig deep to find out all about what we're talking about today. We're excited because Jeannie Edwards is back with us today. Jeannie was with us last week. She's here today, and she'll be back again next week. We are talking about how to help people in a disaster area, or when someone is, you know, when they're incapacitated for one reason or another, or in an accident. Jeannie is the founder of the CPR Gals, and they specialize in disaster preparedness education and first aid training. Question obviously is, you know, not if something's going to happen. The question is when and where. And once you accept that, then you can start preparing for the inevitable with training. And if you get the training, you'll feel a whole lot more comfortable and confident because you can handle pretty much anything that gets thrown at you if you've been taught what to do. And that's what the CPR Gals do. You know, disaster may not always be an earthquake. It may not be a hurricane or a tornado. It all depends on where you live, you know, as to what kind of natural disaster you could be exposed to primarily. Anyway, maybe a loved one or a colleague has collapsed from a heart attack. That's a disaster, and if you're there, you have to know what to do to try and help them. The CPR Gals teach people how to help save lives. They do that by offering classes in CPR and first aid classes so people can be prepared and confident enough to act until uniformed first responders arrive on the scene. It's very interesting that Jeannie was inspired by her grandparents to do this. They were British Red Cross back in the 1920s. Jeannie herself has been a volunteer with the American Red Cross since 1968, and she's been doing this work for over 50 years. She was an EMT for 20 years. She is thoroughly knowledgeable about this subject, and she's really proud of the fact, knowing that she has made a difference in many people's lives. And there is a ripple effect when you do that, no question about it. Anyway, we talked with Jeannie last week a little bit about just what the CPR Gals do and how they help people. They're all over the country, the CPR Gals are. Jeannie is with us today from her base of operations. She moves around a lot. Sometimes she's out in California. She's on the East Coast right now, but she'll be back in the Pasadena area shortly, which is where she has spent much of her time in her life. It's nice to Nice to have you back with us, Jeannie. How are you today, by the way? How you doing?
I'm doing well, and hello out there to everybody in Radio Land.
Good way to put it. You know, they're hearing us all around the world, so it's very interesting. It, you know, people could be, it doesn't matter where people live. They could be in Bangladesh. They could be in, you name the country, Australia, New Zealand. They could be in South America or wherever. Disasters happen. Situations happen where it really pays to know what to do to help other people. What I guess the primary question here is, what prompted you to start this organization, the CPR Gals? And when did you actually do it? How about that? Tell me a little bit about it.
My grandparents, as you mentioned, I think I'm catching your tongue, were British. They moved to Pasadena in 1921. So I grew up in old Pasadena. They were American Red Crossers after they moved here, and I grew up in Red Cross. I also grew up with two very important people in my life, Dr. Richter, who, as everyone knows, invented the Richter scale for earthquakes, and then Dr. Ellis Jones, who was a Vietnam medic, came back, became a doctor, worked at Huntington Memorial, and was one of the handful of men that in the early 1970s helped start what is now the paramedic program in this country. So it's always been ingrained. I've always loved helping people. And I had a knack for learning about disasters and medical care. So volunteering for many years with Red Cross, being an instructor, about 12, 13 years ago, a few of us were sitting around one day and thought, let's start our own company. And we did.
That simple, huh? You just started it. So I know that, you know, you were raised primarily, you live primarily in California, as you mentioned, in Pasadena, which is, you know, it's a suburb of Los Angeles. But where are the people who work with you, the CPR gals? Are they all in that area, or are you all over the country? How about that? How do you answer that?
We have a couple mostly in Pasadena, but now with the advantage of Zoom calls, we can teach pretty much anything over Zoom. About the only thing we cannot do is to certify you in CPR because we need to see your skills with the mannequins. So we've also worked with American Heart and ASHI, which is American Health and Safety Institute. So ASHI does have a program where you can rent the mannequins. They mail them to you. We get on the Zoom call. We test your skills. You mail them back, and we can certify you. So we can pretty much teach anybody anywhere.
And you do it by Zoom. I know you've been doing that during the pandemic, obviously, extensively, and I guess only by Zoom. Can you teach it as well by Zoom than you as you could if you were teaching in-person classes, do you think?
With many of the classes, yes. But for the actual CPR, if you've gone through a class before, you've been certified before, you've already experienced that in person, so it can be done equally well on Zoom. If you're brand new, you've never had a CPR class, it's better to have it done in person.
The question is, how important is it to have certification in CPR? Basically, what you are, I mean, I know you teach people how to teach others, but you can teach people how to use CPR, and even though they may not be certified by the organization, wherever they might be, that certifies people and teaches people in CPR, if you teach it by Zoom, they know it. They know what inherently they should do in a situation. If a neighbor of theirs had a heart attack in front of them, they could spring into action and you know, potentially, hopefully, save that person's life by using CPR, even though they weren't certified. Isn't that right?
Yes, and let me correct one little point. When someone is having a heart attack, that person is conscious. You do not do CPR on conscious people. When heart attacks develop and go into cardiac arrest and the person is unconscious, then you're going to do CPR. So a lot of people think a heart attack and cardiac arrest are the same thing. They are not. A heart attack is, in essence, a plumbing issue with the heart. A cardiac arrest is an electrical issue with the heart's electrical system. So as far as certification goes, not everybody needs it. Not everybody wants it, which is why we came up with the infant presentation, because the official class is child infant CPR first aid. But we teach a lot of new and about to be new parents. So we've concentrated simply on the infants and what to do for that first year or so should something happen. Parents don't care about a piece of paper. So we can teach pretty much anybody. If they work for someone who requires a certification, then that's a little bit different. But, yes, you can still learn it without getting certified.
Right. You mentioned something very interesting here. You're talking about infants. There are three different, classes that you teach or forms of CPR that you do. By the way, for people who don't know what CPR stands for, explain it to them. What does CPR actually mean?
CPR is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So cardio being the heart, pulmonary being the lungs. When we inhale, the oxygen goes into the lungs and the heart pumps the blood around to keep the vital organs alive. But what's keeping the organs alive is the oxygen. So in order to do proper CPR and help keep vital organs going, you need to put in the oxygen, then circulate it, then put in more oxygen, then circulate it, and you just keep doing that until help arrives. And there are, we teach you in class 5 different times when you can stop doing CPR.
Okay, I'm glad you explained that. But what I was about to point out, that there is a form of CPR known as adult CPR. There is child CPR, and there is infant CPR. Is there a big difference between the three? And off the top of my head, I would assume there is. Am I right?
The principle is exactly the same. You're circulating oxygenated blood throughout the body to keep the vital organs alive. The difference comes in because of the anatomy of an infant versus a child versus an adult. You're going to have to put in a lot of oomph when you're dealing with a large adult. With a child or elderly or someone who's just smaller in stature, you do not need as much energy as you would with somebody 250, 300 pounds. The infant, it's the same principle, but they have not developed to the point where, for example, babies choke a lot because they have no control over their swallowing muscles. So we deal with them very gently, and we have a few trips, such as if you've got a choking infant who's conscious, you would, because of their size, hold them properly so you don't drop them, and you turn them upside down because gravity helps drain whatever it is that's in their throat.
Okay. That makes sense.
Good.
Well, anyway, I'm listening to you instruct me. By the way, the CPR, you explained it briefly last week. Tell me again. It involves breathing as well as the pressing on the compressions you do on someone's chest. What's the right way to do it again? You were saying, was it X number, like 12 breaths or 20 breaths, and then start pressing on the chest? Is that right?
It's, in theory, a lot of people are now hearing that you only have to do compressions. And they're calling that CPR, but the pulmonary is totally left out of it. The proper way to do this is A, B, C, like we've always learned, airway, breathing, circulation. So you want to make sure that the airway is clear, and if it is, then you can go ahead and try 2 breaths to get that, to make sure that the airway is clear and get oxygen in the lungs. Then you're going to do 30 compressions to circulate that oxygen throughout the body. Then you're going to give another 2 breaths. Then you're going to circulate it, and then you just keep doing that. Now, if a child, for example, is not breathing, but he still has a pulse, you're going to do rescue breathing. And that would be breathing for about 2 minutes. And then you're going to check the pulse again. If the pulse is still there, you don't need to do that job. So you're going to continue breathing for another couple of minutes, check the pulse. If the pulse has changed, weakened, or just disappeared, then you switch into CPR, and that is 30 compressions and 2 breaths.
Okay. That's very interesting. I was a little off when I said 12 breaths or 20 breaths. It's 2 breaths and then 30 compressions. How long, by the way, should you keep this up? You keep it up until the paramedics arrive. That's primarily the goal, right?
Generally speaking, the 5 times you can stop doing CPR is if there is immediate danger. because we don't want you getting hurt. So get out, and if you can get your victim out with you, terrific. The second time is if the victim starts breathing on his own. Obviously, you don't need to work for him anymore. The third time would be if somebody of equal or higher training comes along to assist you. And CPR can get very tiring. So if there's someone else there that can do it for a few go-rounds, great, but you stay there, and then you guys can switch back and forth if needed. The fourth time would be if an AED shows up, which is an automated external defibrillator. The person who's brought the AED typically is the one to apply it to the person's bare chest, and then it's going to analyze what's going on with the body. Then you stop while the machine is analyzing and then do what it tells you to do, either shock or continue CPR. And then the fifth time you can stop is if you are too exhausted to continue. Not tired, exhausted. You just cannot do it anymore.
Wow. All right. Well, that's pretty good. That's a very good basic information on CPR and how to do it and how long to do it. And hopefully somebody is calling, for emergency aid if something like that happens and the paramedics will arrive. If they don't come, I guess you keep doing it until there's just you're worn out. Maybe somebody else could take your place. I've seen examples of where people actually were doing CPR. The paramedics arrived. They put the person who had been injured on a gurney and put him in an ambulance, and one of the emergency technicians continued to do CPR in the ambulance all the way to the time they got the subject to the hospital. And even moving them into the hospital, they were doing CPR on the gurney. All the way into the emergency room.
Yes.
And eventually the subject passed away. They were keeping him alive, though, for a lengthy period of time. Had they stopped that, I guess he would have died on the scene sooner. But the goal is, hopefully, if you can do it and keep him alive till they get into the ER, then the doctors there can work their magic, which hopefully they would be able to do. That's just
and
one of the classes
doctors,
that... I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
Okay, only doctors can pronounce somebody dead. We can't,
the
EMTs can't, nurses can't. So the other thing is that we don't know if that person's technically alive or not, but by continuing the CPR, circulating that oxygen blood, we're giving that person a chance for the doctors, as you say, to do their magic. Now, the other reason that you want to consider doing this, if that person dies, yet he is an organ donor, and you have kept the vital organs alive by doing CPR, instead of helping to save one life, you may have helped save many more.
That's a very good point. That's an excellent point. I did not mention that. Good for you. Good point. All right, let's take a look at some of the other things you teach. There's a long list of things. By the way, you have a great website where the information is listed. It's the CPRgals.com. The CPRgals.com. And there's a subject here that I find really quite fascinating, and it's called Advanced Bleeding Control. Talk to me a little bit about that. What is Advanced Bleeding Control?
We have all had cuts here and there over the years, and to deal with that, you put on direct pressure, you typically put on a Band-Aid, and you're done. With advanced bleeding control, that is major bleeding. So we went on a call one time at a warehouse. The gentleman was using a box cutter trying to open a box, and he was drawing the blade toward him when we should all be doing it away from us. Well, he slipped, and he got a big gash in his thigh, which hit a major artery, and he was bleeding seriously. So with advanced bleeding control, it's major bleeding. which if it is not stopped within a minute or two, that person can literally die from losing all his blood. So deep cuts, gunshot wounds, other things like that, major trauma situations, you want to get that bleeding stopped as soon as possible. And there are a few different ways that that can be done and a few extra provisions you're going to want to have with you. But that's usually with people who are in an industry where that can happen.
Well, Ken, give me a hint of what you would do to stop someone who had, you know, inadvertently cut themselves in their thigh or wherever. Maybe they had a vein and they were bleeding profusely. You know, we all hear the idea of using a tourniquet. You know, if it's in your arm, you wrap the tourniquet around your shoulder or your arm above where the cut is. But suppose it's in your thigh or something like that. Is the tourniquet still the best idea to use? And you grab whatever you can that can, you know, a necktie, a rope, a belt, or whatever that can serve as a tourniquet? Would that be right?
That is pretty close. With tourniquets, there are manufactured tourniquets that, say, law enforcement and other groups like that carry with them. If you don't have something like that, yes, you can use strips of cloth. You can use old ties. You don't want to use rope because that can kind of make an indentation and do more injury. So the concept with the limbs is to tie an area off above where the wound is. So on the arm, if you've got that, you would want to put it above your elbow, in between your elbow and your shoulder. And on the leg, you're going to put it on the thigh between your knee and your groin. And then with the commercial tourniquet, there's a twisty thing, if you've never seen one. And you twist that to tighten the tourniquet until the blood slows down or hopefully stops. But the first step would be to get direct pressure on that wound and try and stop it that way as somebody else is getting a tourniquet or making one. The point is to basically put enough pressure on the artery that's bleeding out to stop the blood flow.
Okay, exactly. That's the best thing to do, no question. You know, mentioning this and talking about this, it's interesting. I saw something on television the other night, and I questioned it to my wife, who happens to be a nurse. And it involved someone on TV. It was a dramatic show, but she got stabbed in her hand. Someone thrust a knife through her hand. And she sat down. Obviously, they put her on the floor. She was bleeding profusely. And the few people who were around her at the time started wrapping a T-shirt or something around her hand until finally paramedics did arrive on the scene, and they began bandaging her hand. But they never took the knife out of her hand. And my wife was telling me, that's right, you never do that. Why is that? Explain that to me.
Your wife.
And that is correct,
wife,
right?
She's smart. Keep that wife.
okay.
She helps into your life. The reason that you do not want to remove a penetrating object, which is what we call them, it did damage on the way in. Now, if the knife was serrated, it cut the tissue on the way in. Now, if you try and take that out, you're going to do more damage as you're pulling it out. So with objects that are stuck in, rescued people that had rebar through them and some very interesting things, anchors down at the shore, through
right.
their skulls. You get
right.
people in vehicle accidents who have had things go through windshields into their heads. You leave that, you bandage around it, and let the doctors figure out what organs or tissue or whatever this object has penetrated and that will give them a better way to know how to take it out safely without damaging more tissue or cutting a vein or something to that effect.
Well, that's very interesting to know. I mean, there are a lot of people whose first instinct would be to pull the knife right back out, or whatever. You talk about a rebar or something, it would be the same thing. Hey, take that out. But they should not. Leave it in. Let the doctors work on that when they get to the hospital, right?
Exactly. Now, if it's a small splinter, okay, yeah, I'll take it out. But if it's a chunk of wood, leave it.
You know, you cover so many different issues of things that you train people in. We were talking about CPR. We were talking about doing this on adults or children or infants. You also have a category of pet CPR. You do this for pets. You teach it for pets as well, don't you?
We do, and it's pretty much domestic pets, cats and dogs, but it also works on smaller pets like guinea pigs, hamsters, rabbits, and people have also tried it on lizards and squirrels, and it's worked.
Well, I think it's fascinating hearing about the potential for things that you can learn from what you guys do. I know you've been doing this for so long. We have a couple of minutes. Give me an example of something where you were thrust into helping save somebody at some point, and where this knowledge, you know, really came back to help you. Any memories of any specific incidents?
We've had so many different calls as EMS, but one of the greatest things, and our training just kicks in, and you're working with people you've worked with before, but as far as a couple of stories go, with the training, we were doing some training for an infant presentation. The baby had already been born. He was 2 months old, and mom and dad and grandparents and aunts and uncles were there, and the little one was asleep in mom's arms, and all of a sudden he started to kind of sputter. And without thinking, the father got up, and we were past the point of teaching him what to do with conscious choking. He automatically picked the son up, cradled him in his arm, turned him upside down, gave him some back blows, and whatever it was came out. And the family's looking at each other going, this really works, and they were so excited. And I got a call from them about 4 months later. The situation had happened again, and it was a little worse, and they did find out that the baby had a little medical issue in the back of his throat, but they were able to help save their son's life. So we get stories like that.
They had done the right thing, turning him upside down at that point. It
worked.
Exactly. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good to know. That's good to know. Jeannie, I know there are many stories you have. I wish we had more time, but we don't. We're slowly running out of time for our broadcast today. But look, this is great. You'll be back with us again next week. You give me a backlog of stories next week. We'll go through some of them with you. Because you've been doing this for many, many years. You were an EMT in Los Angeles for over 20 years. I'm sure you've seen many things, many disasters and situations where your knowledge of emergency medicine and medical care has come in so handy. So I thank you for being with us. Again, Jeannie Edwards is with us. She is the founder and the head of the CPR Gals, and that's the website, thecprgals.com. Go look at that website. You'll see all the various things they teach you. Babysitting, you teach that, emergency babysitting lessons. Wouldn't think that would be something necessary, but, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Jeannie, thank you for being with us. It's been great having you with us, and we'll see you again next week, same time, okay?
Sounds like a plan, and thank you, everyone. Thank you, guys.
All right, sounds like a plan. I like it. Good enough. Thank you, Jeannie. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Theo, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.
Well, we sure do. That'll do it for this day's edition of Close Up Talk Radio. I'm Doug Llewellyn. See you next time. Bye for now.